Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who discusses the escalating cycle of Middle East violence, which threatens to snuff out hope for reviving Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Author and commentator Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, who examines allegations of voter discrimination in Florida and elsewhere during the 2000 national election. And Gina Kiala of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, who outlines the campaign now underway to pressure President Clinton to grant the imprisoned Native American activist executive clemency. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On November 17th, four Cuban exiles were detained in Panama after Cuban President Fidel Castro warned authorities that the men were plotting to kill him during the Ibero-American summit there. Arrested was Luis Posada Carriles, the admitted mastermind behind the 1997 bombing in Havana that killed an Italian tourist. Miami residents Guillermo Novo and Pedro Ramon are also in custody, both members of the anti-Castro terrorist group Omega 7, once called by a federal prosecutor one of the most dangerous, most vicious, and most feared terrorist groups in U.S. history. Although no weapons or explosives were found at the Panama City Hotel where the men were staying, their historical terrorist activities support Castro's claim that they were plotting against him. According to Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, Posada is accused of blowing up the Cubana airliner in 1976 that killed 73 people, including many of Cuba's Olympic fencing team, an accusation he has always denied. He was also involved in an operation directed by former White House aide Oliver North that supplied the anti-communist Contra Army in Nicaragua. Pedro Ramon was sentenced in 1986 to 10 years in prison after pleading guilty to the attempted murder of Cuba's former delegate to the UN. He was identified as the trigger man in the 1984 machine gun murder of Cuban UN diplomat Felix Garcia Rodriguez. Guillermo Novo was convicted in the 1976 bombing murder of former Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier. When bazooka shots were fired at the UN in 1964, where Che Guevara was speaking at a General Assembly meeting, Novo was arrested, although charges were later dropped. So far, no charges against the men have been filed, but an extradition request for Luis Posada from Venezuelan officials is expected. The Center for Public Integrity, a Washington, D.C.-based research group, reports that an American-made fragment bomb exploded 2 years ago in Colombia, killing at least 19 innocent civilians. Initially, the Colombian government blamed the car bombing in the town of Santo Domingo near the Venezuelan border on the main leftist rebel group FARC, or Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Shortly before the bomb exploded on December 13, 1998, the Colombian army was fighting more than 200 FARC guerrillas near the town. But eyewitnesses reported seeing military airplanes and helicopters overhead at the time of the bombing, conflicting with official government accounts of the incident. Now, samples of metal and fuse fragments sent to the FBI's crime lab in Washington, D.C., tell an interesting story. The agency bomb experts have concluded in a secret report that the bomb fragments were consistent with an American-designed AN-M41 fragmentation bomb and fuse. Officially, the U.S. Defense Department refused to comment on the FBI report, but an unnamed military officer in Colombia confirmed that the U.S. government has in the past given the Colombian government fragment bombs. Winifred Tate of the Washington Office on Latin America observed, "This case shows two things. One is the misuse of U.S. military assistance to kill civilians. The second is the fact that the Colombian military has consistently lied in order to obstruct human rights investigations." Since the early 1970s, food producers have injected chickens, hogs, and other livestock with small doses of antibiotics to spur animal growth. Over the years, agribusiness has gotten fatter livestock, but increasingly public health officials and environmentalists worry about a possible backlash, namely the growing resistance to antibiotics that are effective in fighting diseases in human beings. According to Mother Jones magazine, the Federal Food and Drug Administration recognized the problem over 20 years ago when the agency tried to ban the injection of common drugs into farm animals. But the FDA pulled back after getting lots of complaints from agribusiness. In 1997, the World Health Organization declared that drugs used in human medicine should not be injected into farm livestock. Later, the European Union banned the agricultural use of four antibiotics. Yet the U.S. government is still avoiding the controversy. A federal action plan to deal with growing resistance to antibiotics completely ignored the issue of using drugs to boost growth of farm animals. Now, public interest groups want to put the issue back onto the federal agenda. Dr. David Wallinga of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis comments, "These drugs are too important for human health to risk using them to fatten chickens. If these resistant strains are widespread, then there is not much we'll be able to do." This week's news summary was compiled by Denise Manzari and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Overshadowed in the U.S. media by the unsettled presidential election, the death toll in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict continues to rise. The November 20th bombing of an Israeli school bus in the Gaza Strip set off the latest wave of violence to engulf the Middle East. Palestinian authorities denied responsibility for the remote-controlled bomb, which killed two Israeli settlers and maimed several children. In retaliation for the bombing, Israeli forces attacked and destroyed the headquarters of Palestinian Security Forces, the offices of Yasser Arafat's Fatah party, and a government television station. Escalating violence over the past 2 months has claimed 250, mostly Palestinian, lives. One-third of those killed by the Israeli military have been children. Some supporters of Israel charge that Yasser Arafat is purposefully sacrificing Palestinian children during this latest intifada, in a cynical bid to win world sympathy. They claim he is attempting to win the battle for a Palestinian state on the streets, an objective which eluded him at the negotiating table. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, communications director with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, who discusses the escalating cycle of Middle East violence and responds to the allegation that Arafat is martyring Palestinian children.
Whenever a mostly unarmed population has risen up against a huge armed force, particularly in an anti-colonial struggle, but also, by the way, in the civil rights movement in the United States, it's the youth that takes the lead. Of course they take the lead. I mean, needless to say, they are young, they are strong, they are reckless. They don't have children of their own for the most part. They don't have jobs. These are the people who inevitably lead a popular uprising by an oppressed population. And, of course, it's the same in Palestine. Now, the oppressive power, the force, the military that's enforcing an occupation, an oppression, what have you, they've got no choice. Unless they're willing to, reverse their policy and allow for the liberation of the population, they're going to have to shoot the people. That's what they have to do. That's what they do. And in this case, as in so many others, the targets have to be, and in fact are, children. Now, this was the case certainly in the civil rights movement in the United States. I think we all remember the images, searing images, of the governor of Alabama turning the water hoses and the dogs on the children of Birmingham. Why? Because it was the children of Birmingham and the youth in SNCC who were leading the civil rights movement. And the siren song came from supporters of Jim Crow, from segregationists, from the racists. Why is Martin Luther King sending the kids out of school? These people are barbarians. Don't they have any morality? Similarly, in South Africa, I'll just give you two examples that people probably know about. The massacres at Sharpeville and Soweto, where a preponderance of those killed were youths and children. And, the Afrikaner racist white governments at the time said the same thing. The ANC, the blacks, are sending out their kids to be killed. They're trying to score propaganda points, and that's why they're doing it, and we have no choice, riot control, etc. I mean, this is the siren song. And ironically, by the way, in the late 40s, when the Jewish population of Palestine came into conflict with the British authorities, there were a couple of instances in which British forces had opened fire on Jewish rioters in Palestine and had killed teenagers. And the same arguments on both sides. I mean, the Jewish community said, how could British soldiers kill children? Which I think is a very good question, as yet, you know, to this date unanswered. The British line was, how cowardly are the Jews of Palestine to send their children out to be shot? You know, I could sit here and tell you that Israeli soldiers are psychotic, bloodthirsty racists who like to kill Palestinian children, and I could dump before you the bodies of 70 kids shot in the past 7 weeks as evidence. But I think that would be really a kind of a ridiculous argument to make, in fact. Most of the Israeli soldiers are not psychopaths. They're not psychotic. They don't go out into the field, you know, they don't wake up in the morning and say, boy, I really want to kill a child today. But neither, I mean, it's even more ridiculous, I think, to imagine that Palestinian parents wake up in the morning and say, boy, I want my kids to get killed today. Or the Palestinian children wake up saying, boy, it's a great day to be a martyr for Palestine. You know, I mean, what you have is a structural relationship, a relationship of occupation, where the occupation army, the Israeli army, is suppressing a popular uprising, and like all other occupiers and all other oppressors, they have resorted to shooting the people. And that means, in this case, also shooting kids. Okay? They're shooting them indiscriminately, and they're shooting them brutally, because that's the only way, you, in the end, you can back up a military occupation like this one, an oppressive situation like this. So what we're listening to when we hear that idea that, as in the New York Times, William Safire tries to talk about a campaign of sacrificing Palestinian women and children. First of all, it's racist. Secondly, it's ridiculous. Thirdly, it's beneath contempt. And we, who support the Palestinian cause, I like to think, and certainly in my case it's the case, would not be reduced to the point of trying to argue that Israeli soldiers want to kill Palestinian children. But it's even more absurd, and I would wish that the supporters of Israel would rise above, sinking to the debased, the truly debased and racist level of arguing that Palestinians want their children to be killed or want to be killed to score propaganda points. And just one further thing. Many of the people who say this, who make this argument, don't seem to catch what it implies, if it were true, what it would imply about the justice and the circumstances of the situation. If the best weapon Palestinians really have against Israeli occupation is getting killed en masse by Israelis, what does that tell you about the relative balance of power and the relative justice of the situation? I mean, I think it would tell you a great deal. And what we're looking at is not child sacrifice. What we're looking at is not anything like that. It is an uprising out of total desperation of a people driven to extreme and heroic actions by 33 years of occupation that seems like it will never end, and we keep being told by the Israelis, in effect, that it isn't going to end. And, you know, they have been driven to picking up stones and going out into the streets every day to face the might of one of the world's largest and, I'm sorry to say, most ruthless armies.
That was Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Contact the committee at area code 202-244-2990 or visit their website at www.adc.org. The Democrats and Republicans' unprecedented fight for the presidency more than 2 weeks after Election Day has inspired many citizens to scrutinize the long-hidden flaws in our nation's electoral and political system. But while the corporate media focused on the legal and public relations battle over Florida's 25 electoral votes, little, if any, attention has been paid to the issue of voter disenfranchisement due to discrimination and intimidation. Shortly after the polls closed on November 7th, African American leaders in Florida claimed that black voters were the victims of systematic harassment and intimidation. Allegations included election officials turning away voters with a dubious explanation that the precinct had run out of ballots. Others claim police checkpoints were set up in some cities in an attempt to deter voters from going to the polls. Discrimination against people of color during elections is not a new phenomenon in the U.S., especially in the South. The civil rights struggles of the 1960s were waged in large part to win suffrage for African Americans, who, through literacy tests and poll taxes, were denied the right to vote. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and commentator Dr. Earl Afari Hutchinson, who examines allegations of voter discrimination in Florida and elsewhere during the 2000 national election.
Oftentimes, when you look at the history of voter suppression or just flat-out voter disenfranchisement, particularly in the South, generally you think of African Americans, and in the Southwest, you think of Latinos, and actually in parts of the Pacific Northwest, you think of Asians. But especially in the South with African Americans, that's probably been the longest and certainly the most vicious and violent history of disenfranchisement in American political history. You know, even there, I have to remind people that, yes, it was Southern Democrats for decades that denied the votes through every kind of ploy and ruse in the book, up to and including lynching, beatings, shootings, and just stark naked terror against the African American population. But also, there was a connivance in allowing that to happen on the part of Northern Republicans. With that political connivance between Northern Republicans and Southern Democrats, yes, it did exercise a long kind of vote chill on African Americans and Latinos. Now, we carry over 35 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and we still see some of the same patterns in the South, not as naked, not as blatant, not as overt, but subtle kinds of patterns, subtle kinds of pressures not to vote, subtle kinds of things that countywide registrars and even in urban areas, registrars use to discourage many African Americans and others from voting.
You know, I go back a few years ago to remember reports of Republicans dressing up in certain uniforms with armbands on, and they were purportedly out in front of polling places trying to intimidate people of color, mostly the people who are Latin and maybe were unsure of their registration. They would ask for IDs. But what else can you sort of fill in here about the kinds of things that mainstream America really has no clue about, thinks for the most part these issues of voter discrimination are ancient history?
There were some allegations of not just in Tampa but also the Tallahassee area of the Highway Patrol, in this case the Florida Highway Patrol, throwing up roadblocks and checkpoints, and essentially under the guise of looking for those driving without a license or drugs or other kind of contraband, were stopping, it seemed, an inordinate or disproportionate number of African Americans who just so happened to be going to the polls in many cases, or at least, you know, a process of thinking about going to the polls. So that was one instance. Then, of course, checking IDs, losing ballots at some places, or claiming that they didn't have an ample supply of ballots. And, of course, these just happened to be, according to the allegations, in heavily Latin or African American areas. And then, of course, we know the strangely configured ballot in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I understand that there have been some very creative configuration of the ballot in other parts of Florida, too, and indeed other parts of the South. So essentially, you've had a lot of these things, ID checks, challenges. Then we had the thing as you know, in Florida, along with 12 other states, they ban ex-felons from voting. So that's another way of saying, were you convicted, were you arrested, convicted of a charge, and did you serve time? Was it a felony conviction? So right away, that was challenging, too, to a lot of people. And I understand that some who answered in the affirmative were told flat out, you can't vote, you can't even register, and you can't vote. So you've had a lot of those things that go on, and I think that, you know, it's had a dampening effect. There's no question about that. Even with all of that said, even with irregularities, perhaps some fraud, intimidation, and just a whole range of things that probably did go on in Florida, involving African Americans disproportionately and Latinos. Still, Gore is awful lucky in a sense. He really needs to fall down on his knees and thank whoever he thanks up there. Because if, in fact, African-American, and especially African-Americans, although Latinos, they split it down the middle in Florida. It was about 49% for Bush, about 48% for Gore. If, in fact, African-Americans by a percentage of 95% to 5% did not, might as well just say, for all practical purposes, exclusively the African-American vote went for Gore, if that didn't happen, we wouldn't be on the phone talking about it now. He would have lost Florida. It wouldn't even have been an issue. It would never have gone as far as it's gone because he would have lost that state overwhelmingly. So you've got a situation now where even with all of the allegations and charges of vote fraud, irregularities, and other kinds of things aimed at African Americans and Latinos, Gore was still lucky he got as far as he got in Florida, even though African Americans pretty much, you know, gave Gore carte blanche this election. You know, the question we still must ask, what is the Democratic Party actually doing for the African-American voter in terms of rewarding that relentless, unswerving loyalty to the Democratic Party? And as you know, Scott, you know, from some of the things that I've written and said, you know, I take a pretty hard line on that one. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter is, yes, you do, race politics does dominate the American political scene, and I suspect it's going to be that way for a long time.
That was Dr. Earl Afari Hutchinson, who serves as president of the National Alliance for Positive Action. Visit the Alliance website at www.natalliance.org. Native American activist Leonard Peltier has been imprisoned for 24 years, convicted in the killing of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Since his conviction, witnesses have come forward to reveal that during the trial, U.S. government prosecutors withheld critical information from defense attorneys, which many believe would have exonerated Peltier. Despite two decades of appeals, all efforts for a new trial have been rejected. Leonard Peltier's only hope now is a grant of executive clemency from President Clinton, serving his final weeks as head of state. Peltier's defense committee is asking supporters to call the White House comment line to demand clemency. The group is also organizing a free Peltier demonstration at United Nations headquarters in New York City, December 10th. In a recent interview, President Clinton told Pacifica Radio's Amy Goodman that he would review Peltier's case and reach a decision on whether or not to grant him executive clemency before leaving office in January. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gina Kiala of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, who summarizes the goals of her group's current campaign.
We need supporters to know and understand that knowing that he's looking at it and planning to make a decision in the very near future is just more important than ever to make the phone calls, make sure that line is flooded so he knows he's not going to have to deal with a lot of backlash from the public that will fully support a decision. So that's what our main concern is. I know that he didn't make any kind of commitment, but this is as far as we've ever been. He actually commented on it and said that he's definitely going to decide on it, and for the last 7 years we've had nothing. So it's a development, and shows how important it is for people to really voice their concerns on the White House comment line and also come to New York City on December 10th and support the event that we're organizing for clemency.
And explain what you're doing on December 10th, what's happening, who's coming, and why did you pick that day?
December 10th is Human Rights Day. And it's obviously a very important human rights issue. It's also critical timing for the clemency because obviously it's after the elections and before the inauguration, and that's our window of opportunity. So that's the time that's most important for people to show their support. And so what we'll be doing is we'll be gathering in Union Square at noon, and we'll be walking to the United Nations, where from 2 to 4 there'll be a program of speakers and cultural activities. And we're hoping to mobilize as many people as possible to take part.
And you're bringing in people from Pine Ridge as well?
Right. We're bringing in about 30 people from Pine Ridge. Okay. There's also buses coming from the Wampanoags and various other places.
The Wampanoags in Massachusetts?
Is right.
What do you expect will happen if Clinton doesn't give executive clemency before he leaves office?
Oh, I don't even want to go there. What will happen is we will have to just really look into what possibilities are left, and we'll have to work really hard on getting those 6,000 documents that the FBI continues to withhold released, and we'll just have to do some serious strategizing and figure out what options we have. But this is the time to act, definitely. This is a great opportunity, one that we haven't had in years and won't have again for years to come. So we're not thinking about the results too much at this point. We're just pushing as hard as we can to make it happen.
What is Leonard's state at this point, both physically and emotionally?
He's pretty hopeful. Like I said, this is as close as it's been in a really long time. So he's pretty hopeful, a little bit nervous, and health-wise, he's feeling okay. His jaw condition is still a little bit gives him a little bit of difficulties, but nowhere like it was before he had the surgery. He has some, you know, pretty serious health problems that put him at risk for things like stroke, diabetes. He has diabetes. It puts him at risk for stroke, heart disease, blindness, and kidney failure. And that's something that could easily develop. But at this point, he's doing okay.
Mm-hmm. What is the comment line that you want people to call? This is the White House comment line, and you want people to just ask the president to give executive clemency. That's the one sentence phone call.
Right. The number is 202-456-1111. When you call, if you want to bypass the recording, just press 0. And if people can call as often as possible at this point, it really will have a tremendous effect. You know, we really need to have that line flooded. So, you know, if you can call three times a week, that'd be great. If you can call every day, that'd be even better.
That was Gina Kiala of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 785-842-5774 or visit their website at www.freepeltier.org. The White House comment line can be reached at area code 202-456-1111. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.